This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, weary travelers, to another road-tested episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com. .com. .flea circus.
I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and colleague. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
This is the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. So good, it's at least as creepy as every wax museum you've ever been to. If you agree that this is a creepy show, but you want to hear more, if you're enticed and you're appalled, but you're also oddly attracted, our entire back catalog is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/you guessed it. Junk Food Cinema, and of course, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema is a really great way to support the show directly, because what we were going to do is we were going to start laying traps out by the highway and hoping to basically trick people into coming in here and then stealing their faces, and it was like I hadn't quite figured out step three, but step four was profit. So if you want to avoid us going down that road entirely, you can always go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And for as little as $4 a month, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. So I highly recommend jumping on that bandwagon and becoming a patron today. Okay, so Schlocktober continues. And this week is going to be a very interesting episode because we are talking about a movie that for years and years and years I have been beating the drum for. I've been in love with this movie since I first saw it at Terror Tuesday, back when Zach Carlson was still the host. And, you know, it was just one of those movies that really blew me away. I'd never heard of it. And it's a gem, a real roadside attraction. I'm talking, of course, about 1979's Tourist Trap.
Every year, hundreds of young people travel the country and disappear. God help those who get caught in the tourist trap. Heart-stopping suspense that makes this the nightmare that never ends. Something crazy's going on at the tourist trap.
The interesting part about this is that we are going to have a lot to discuss because our levels of affinity for this movie are slightly obtuse or off a little bit.
As in, I don't like this movie.
Yes, this is true.
And this is going to be a special Junk Food Cinema because we rarely do this.
Yeah, we have a rule where if one of us really hates a movie, you know, we don't talk about it because the whole point of the show is about genuine love and no irony and really getting to the heart of why these movies that other people have written off are things that we truly love. Now, Cargill, even though you didn't like this movie, you still mentioned to me that there are several things about it that you thought were very noteworthy.
Well, that's the thing, is I don't like this movie, but I'm very happy that I saw it. It is exactly the type of movie that I want to talk about because there are people that will dig this movie or do dig this movie. And there's a lot about this movie that, first of all, I mean, let's just lay it out there. There's a pedigree to this movie that it's like, oh, of course we have to talk about this on Junk Food Cinema. There are certain elements to it that we will get to that it's like, well, yes, this is your wheelhouse. And also, it's just a weird fucking movie. That's
so bizarre.
Three different movies put in a blender and served up in such a weird way that I don't think works, but I think is admirable in what it's trying to do. And there are things worth watching it for. And so the fact that you love it, and I was still like, this is just fucking crazy enough that I want to have a conversation about it. That fuck yeah, let's talk about Tourist Trap. Because there is so much going on in this movie. A movie that I had not heard of. Like, you kept saying Tourist Trap, and I kept thinking it was Death Valley.
Okay. Yeah, with Peter Billingsley.
Yeah. And that was the, and I was like, oh, okay, it's people driving in the desert, and it's, and no. And then once I start watching it, I'm like, I have never heard of this fucking movie. How have I not heard of this?
So my favorite text from Cargill of all time was the other night when he said, are we talking about, and I said, Tourist Trap, and he said, are we talking about the 2010 version? And I looked it up. There is no movie called Tourist Trap that released in 2010. There is a movie called The Tourist with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie. And two thoughts immediately entered my head. One, I was incensed that you think I would ever want to fucking talk about that movie. But then two, I was delighted at the idea that you thought that movie was bad enough that it is in fact a fucking horror film to actually sit through The Tourist.
No, there is another movie called Tourist Trap that is an obscure direct-to-video thing. What happened was I looked up Tourist Trap on Amazon and it said Tourist Trap 2010 and had this post, the poster for Tourist Trap.
Oh.
And what it was it was listed that way because that was the year the Blu-ray was released.
I see.
And okay. So Amazon had it erroneously listed as the 2010 version. And so I was like, where is this? What year? And you were like 1979. And so I Google that and it's like, oh, that's the same poster for the design. Oh, I see what happened here. I can watch this movie.
Can I sidebar this for just a second? So I'm on Hulu and I've gotten to the point where I try to have as many different streaming services as possible, as many different options as I can, so that paired with my physical media collection means I can watch any fucking movie I want at any time. You know, just if I'm willing to rent it and pay for it, you can kind of do that right now. But so I'm on Hulu and I'm at first praising them for their incredible horror selection. They've added a bunch of great horror, which they have to their credit. And I'm sitting down the other night and looking for my, what I call my pizza movie. I've literally ordered a pizza, but the sentiment is the same whether or not the pizza is physically there. It's a movie where it's just like, it's a Friday night. I've got nothing to do. I'm comfortable. I have a moment of peace because any of you who are new dads know that those are few and far between when you have an infant. And it's just like, oh my God, I want to sit down and I just want to watch a comfort food movie. So I've got literally my pizza. It's just been delivered. And I sit down. I time it so that when I sit down, I'm going to start the movie as I take the first bite. And Hulu has The Fog. And I look and it's that poster. It's that iconic poster from John Carpenter's The Fog.
Oh,
and
I'm
so excited.
Oh,
and
no.
I hit start.
Oh, no.
And it's the fucking remake.
Oh, no.
And I'm not mad that they have the remake. I'm mad because those motherfuckers thought it was appropriate to use the original poster to trick me into thinking I was going to watch the original and then fucking bushwhack me with the remake. You want to talk about a goddamn tourist trap? It's setting a sign on the side of the road that says original Fog this way, and I turn right and I'm smack dab in the middle of fucking Tom Wellington. Go fuck yourself. But I digress.
You a lot.
Stargrove. I digress.
Stargrove.
All that to say, Tourist Trap.
Stargrove.
Tourist Trap does not make me as angry as Hulu did the other night. Tourist Trap is, you're right, it's a lot of different movies thrown into a blender. What I love about Tourist Trap, first and foremost, is I grew up, my dad is like an encyclopedia. The way that you and I are with cult movies, my dad is with television from about 1955 to 1985. Like, he just knows everything. And he can recite facts off the top of his head. And one of the shows he used to talk about the most was The Rifleman.
Oh, yeah.
The Rifleman was Chuck Connors as the biggest fucking dude in the Old West with the biggest fucking gun. And the great thing about it is that apparently, I don't know if this was, but my dad was telling this before or after he was on the show. I think it was before. He was called the Rifleman when he played basketball. Chuck Connors was, because he was just always shooting. And which sounds like, it sounds like a great nickname until you remember that a rifle is not the most accurate gun in the world. A shotgun, a rifle, not, it's not about accuracy. It's just about kind of creating that blast.
That's a shotgun.
Yeah. Well, but still, it casts aspersions on your proficiency as a basketball player when it's like, we call you that just because you shoot a lot. Not because you make a lot of baskets, you just shoot a lot. And what I love about Tourist Trap is it comes about in this era when Chuck Connors was trying to reinvent himself as a cult movie icon. He wanted to play more roles exactly like this one. This was what he was going for at this time, and it never took off. But I personally believe Chuck Connors was born to fucking play roles like this. He is so, so unnerving and so creepy, and at the same time, in the same movie, plays like the sweetest old man. And like the duality of that and the way that comes together. And yes, it's a twist ending that's telegraphed, like the script was written by Samuel Morris. I get that.
So much so there's a fake out in the credits just to try to distract you.
Yeah. No, and I totally get that, but I still love the way Chuck Connors brings to these roles. He tries to differentiate them. Like, one of the characters has a limp and the other doesn't. Like, he is really going for it and making choices. Like, he is really sinking his teeth into these roles. And I love what he comes up with. But the basic premise here is that a bunch of teens are on a road trip. And teens might be a little generous. They're 30-somethings. But as most horror movies are, they're 30-somethings who I think are playing teenagers.
Hold on. First of all, they're not just a bunch of teens. It's a bunch of teens and Tanya fucking Roberts.
Tanya Roberts, who is one of the most beautiful women alive and one of the worst actresses ever committed to film. Oh my God, this poor woman cannot act. Part of that for me comes from being a Bond fan, and she is to this day one of the worst Bond girls of all time. But she's very much perfect for a movie like this. And
for those of you that are like, why do we have this affection for Tanya Roberts? In fact, I had this conversation with my wife because she's just because I was tripping out that Tanya Roberts was in this. And my wife was like, why are you into her? She's really not your type. Like, you have a very specific, because I have a very specific type and Tanya Roberts isn't it. And she's like, what is it about Tanya Roberts? Like, you know, that you're just like tripping on this. And I'm like, for men of a certain age, she was there and ubiquitous in, you know, in the right kind of cult pop culture stuff.
Yeah.
Particularly where most of us know her from is Beastmaster.
See, that's so funny. I was just imagining you saying to your wife, like, no, you have to imagine her in a loincloth. You have to really, the thing you got to remember is she wore a loincloth. And it's like, okay,
but
yeah, no.
She was in Beastmaster and she was a Bond girl. And so, yeah. At that point in the early 80s, like, this is what Hollywood is saying. This is what a woman looks like. And we're like, yes, okay.
We accept that. Thank you, Hollywood.
And so this is that Tanya Roberts film I had never seen. And so yes, they are getting back into it. They are driving around in a Jeep.
Yeah, like you do. Just all of them driving around in a
Jeep. We don't know where they're going.
No. Nope.
We don't know pretty much the names of almost any of the characters.
I think they're going to MacGuffinville.
They have no personalities whatsoever. In fact, their personalities are painted on with their clothing. Like, you could tell which character is which purely by what they're wearing.
Oh, yeah. There's Tube Top. There's Pollyanna. There's Gilligan. If we're just judging them by their clothing.
Because they have no other personalities.
I joke that she's Pollyanna. Her name in the movie is actually fucking Polly.
Yeah, no, she is. Yeah, in fact, it's that character in particular is, you almost think the first time you're watching it that she's going to end up living with Chuck Connors there as his new wife. Like, they're almost setting up that storyline in a very weird way. They're not selling it, but like, all the pieces are there and you're like, I don't know where this is going. But this is the most logical progression of all the information they've given us.
She seems like the type of woman who, if you met her in real life and you asked her where she lived, she could not describe her home without using the word compound.
By the way,
she lives on a compound.
We need to stress something real quick. This is a Charles Band movie.
It is. And I was actually surprised. I didn't notice that the first time I watched it. I had no recollection of this being a Charles Band movie.
I have now run into three people that have worked with Charles Band. And every time they're like, oh, Charlie. And it's like, Why do we not call him Charlie Band if everyone calls him Charlie? But yeah, Charles Band, this is early on before Full Moon Pictures, before he went full on into I'm going to make direct-to-video movies, where he was trying to make mainstream films. We've already talked about one of his movies, The Eliminators.
The Eliminators.
Which is our easily our favorite Charles Band movie. And then, of course, he did crazy shit like
Parasite.
Parasite 3D. Mm-hmm. In which was the one of the first gigs, the first professional gig of Charles Neuwirth, a producer I worked on Doctor Strange, who would go on to produce such small things as RoboCop and Forrest Gump and Galaxy Quest, and then working with Marvel making movies like Doctor Strange.
I feel like there was somebody else who got their big break in that movie Parasite, but I'm...
Maybe a young actress like Demi Moore?
Yeah, I don't know if that was it, but... Oh, yeah, no, it's fucking Demi Moore. It's absolutely Demi Moore.
Yeah, it's... And that's an odd movie we won't end up talking about. it's, you know, it's a thing. It's a thing.
To set the record straight, by the way, I know you won't agree with this. This is actually my favorite Charles Band movie.
Really? You like this more than Eliminators?
I do like this more than Eliminators. Because Eliminators has its charm for me, absolutely. But I still, as bug nuts as this movie is, I still really like what it's trying to do. And I still really like the performances. And I think there's a lot of art in this. It's just packaged in a really fucking crazy box.
I had not put this together, but these... I'm glad we're talking about this because these two films show exactly how Charles Band's mind works. Because Eliminators is, hey, let's take everything about the 80s that kids like and throw it together in a movie. And this movie is, let's take everything horror movie audiences like and throw it all together in a movie. We've got creepy hillbilly in the woods. We have a bunch of teenagers wandering into some place in the woods. We have some kind of creepy tourist attraction slash wax museum. And we have psychic powers. This is 1979. This is right at, you know, Carrie has happened already. This is right at the dawn of a bunch of this psychic stuff that we ended up talking about. We did Psychic Month a ways back, where this is where all this stuff was coming from. This is actually at the forefront of Psychic Month, you know, like, you know, Scanners had not happened yet. We had not gotten to Phenomena yet. We had not gotten Firestarter, Stephen King's biggest psychic power stuff.
By the way, Stephen King, a big fan of Tourist Trap, as it turns out.
Shocker. I am shocked.
No, that was Wes Craven. Set him up and knock him down.
It does not surprise me because this very much is ripping off Carrie, but doing something different than Carrie, which is part of the reason I found this fascinating. The psychic element to this movie was the one where I was like, oh, shit. So this isn't just mannequins and fucking killing teenagers in the woods. Like, there's this whole other element here that, by the way, recontextualizes things that happen in the movie, and I admired that. The fact that they break down, they don't just break down. The villain uses his psychic powers to break their car down, to trap them there, so he can then do his wickedness to them. The wickedness is where this movie, I honestly think, goes off the rails, and we'll talk about that. But I love the crazy psychic shit in this, and I love how broken this guy is and what he does with the psychic shit.
Yeah.
Like, it is not what you'd expect from a psychokinetic. Because, again, we say psychic stuff. He's a psychokinetic. He's a telekinetic. He can...
Psychokinetic. Qu'est-ce que c'est?
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba- I was just going to go on and do Psycho
Killer.
Welcome
to Junk Food Karaoke.
Yeah, because Psycho Killer is the perfect kind of song for this.
True story.
But yeah, like he uses his psychokinetic powers to move mannequins around and make them do creepy shit. And that's kind of fucking cool.
And that, to me, visually, is where the sting of this movie is. And what, to this day, the very first time I saw it and revisiting it for the show, the thing that haunts me about this movie is all of the stuff with the mannequins moving and the mannequins' mouths opening and the sounds that accompany, like the choral singing that accompanies it. And like, there, very early on in this movie, when Gilligan, the first dopey teen that wanders into the tourist trap, gets murdered. The first thing that happens is he walks into a room where he thinks a woman is crouched down on the floor, and he goes to talk to her. And I will tell you this. I had seen this movie before, and I got fooled again. I did get fooled again. Sorry, The Who. Because he goes, excuse me, ma'am. And it just, this thing flips back, and it's a dummy. And I was like, holy shit. Like, it freaked me out again, because it does look like a woman hunched over. And when you move into the rest of the film and you see how the killer is dressed, it looks like the way the killer is dressed. And then it turns out to be this mannequin that just starts cackling. And it's then joined by a bunch of other mannequins that start cackling. And I feel like this is what goes on in Joe Spinell's head all of the time in Maniac. Like, everything that happens in this movie is what is basically the ending of Maniac, what he sees in his head. And it's just fucking horrifying. Like, watching these things just, their jaws just like drop open, like it's Anaconda Day, and their jaws just drop open, and then there's just this, either this laughter or this like, ah! And it sounds silly me describing it, but the way that they play it in the movie, it's very unsettling.
Yeah, and it works. And like, that's, again, there are these great visuals. There are these crazy fucking ideas that are executed in a really fascinating way, that this is why I wanted to talk about this, because I do admire the audacity of some of the stuff they're doing and the ideas that they're coming up with. I just don't think it's sewn together properly. And again, we will continue. There is one big thing. There is one big sequence in this movie. Let me just lay it out there. There's one sequence in this movie that made me hate this movie. And it is when we finally are with Davey. Davey is the crazy brother who's, doing crazy shit.
I don't know, Davey. It seems like this is bullshit.
And Davey is really crazy exposition guy, because every word out of Davey's mouth is explaining Davey to us. Like, there is no, there is an absence of subtlety. You can't say there's no subtlety. There's actually negative subtlety to the writing of Davey.
It starts stealing subtlety from other movies.
It's a black hole of subtlety in which he's just spilling out all the necessary information to understand this crazy guy, as if they had written the script and somebody said, I don't understand this villain. And they explain it. The screenwriter explains it, and they're like, yeah, the audience isn't going to get that. So can we have a scene where he sits there and talks like this through his mask and explains why he's killing everybody and gives us all the information that we need?
I know exactly where that came from. That is Charles Band sitting in the room when they're pitching this meeting and going, because first, let's get this out of the way. This movie doesn't exist if Texas Chainsaw wasn't a hit.
Oh, God, no.
This movie doesn't fucking, like, the mask that this killer wears might as well have been they call him, in fact, in the production, they called him, I think, Plastic Face, as a joke on the fact that he's basically Leatherface. Like, the wig surrounding the mask and the mask itself, it's like, you look almost exactly like fucking Leatherface. But Charles Band sat in that pitch meeting and went, you know what my problem is, though, with Texas Chainsaw Massacre? You don't know why they're doing it. I want to know why they're doing it. I feel like we need to know why they're doing it. So have him tell us why he's doing it. And somebody in the back of the room was too afraid to go, well, that's the whole point, is it's actually scarier if you don't. Oh, okay. You're giving me how much? Okay, sure. He'll say whatever you want.
You're right. Let's just dump the twist out there. For those of you that haven't watched it yet, Chuck Connors is Davey, too. I mean, you've already kind of, you know, thrown all the breadcrumbs out there, and he's committed to this, but he's trying to sell it so hard that it's not him.
Yeah.
That the performance is really awful of everything in the mask with Davey.
Well,
like, everything. Like, I'm supposed to be frightened of Davey. I'm supposed to at least see him as a threat. And it's just Chuck Connors talking like he's Batman wearing a mask. Oh, hey, watch this cool trick I could do with a key. I'm moving it with my mind. That's telekinesis. Totally didn't rip that off from Carrie. Like you said, this movie wouldn't exist without, if Texas Chainsaw wasn't a hit, this movie wouldn't exist if Carrie wasn't a hit. Like, this is literally, we took Carrie, we took Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then we we took every other kind of slasher movie of the day and threw that together. It's also Psycho is the other movie. Yeah. This is because it's mother in the house doing it. It's not me. I'm just the nice guy helping you.
Yeah.
And no, I'm really the psychokinetic mass killer who's obsessed with turning people into wax sculptures, which is also from House of Wax.
Okay.
Like,
slow down. God damn it. You're stepping on everything. No, you're stepping on everything I want to say. First of all, thank you for mentioning Christian Bale, because it dawned on me in this viewing that what this twist really is it's a reverse Prestige. There is no twin brother. It's the exact opposite of the big twist of the Prestige. So thank you for mentioning Christian Bale. And yes, absolutely.
Why'd you say that name?
Oh, I'm sorry, Ben.
Buttman.
It is definitely, it owes so much to Psycho because, yeah, it's like, it's not me, it's mom in the house, or in this case, it's brother in the house. Also, I feel like...
Yeah, there's the house you don't go into because the hotel's over here. I mean, the wax museum is over here. Yeah.
But all that being said, I feel like while there are scenes where that doesn't work, there are also scenes where I feel like it doesn't work, but it's a lot of ADR. Like,
oh, yeah.
The whole scene where he's like applying the plaster to her face, almost everything said by Davey feels ADR. And I'm like, is there a cut of this movie where they shot that and very much like Leatherface, he just didn't say anything? Because I feel like that would be so much more effective. All that being said, I am really impressed with Chuck Connors being able to, not so much with the Davey stuff, but with what he does with the other character who actually runs... the museum, the wax museum that is the tourist trap, Mr. Slauson, he makes that character so charming and so sweet and so likable.
100% agree. Everything with Chuck Connors as Mr. Slauson is great. And it is part of what endeared me to the movie enough not to dislike it for the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
You know, it's because, I mean, you get the reason you actually connect with these teenagers is not because, and we say teenagers because we literally know nothing about these characters.
Nothing.
The writing of these characters is more hollow than most. Like this is the worst example, one of the worst examples of this trope of characters you just don't give a shit about. And the only reason you care about them at all is the pure charisma of Tanya Roberts and the woman playing Polly. Like they genuinely have charisma to them that endear you to them enough to care about the movie when Chuck Connors isn't on screen. And when Chuck Connors is on screen, it's like, oh, finally someone I care about, even though I know he's really the killer.
Yeah.
Like I like the killer. And that's a problem in these movies, because these movies at this point in cinema history, you were not supposed to side with the villains. That wouldn't happen for another couple of years where you started rooting for the villains and not the victims.
Yeah.
And you're not supposed to like him, but you're supposed to be conned by him, and it works. And that element works. And Mr. Slauson is kind of endearing and kind of hokey and really like and understands it and gets it and is fine being who he is. He's, what I like about him and what I like about the writing and his performance is it goes against a lot of Hollywood. Hollywood has a disdain for rural America and doesn't hide it. You know, rural America is dangerous. It's scary. It's where all our horror movies take place.
Yeah.
This is one of those movies that, much like last week's movie, Pumpkinhead, loves its location. Like it loves this southern guy. It's like, hey, yeah, me and my wife just found a little slice of heaven and we built a thing here, and you know, we built a museum, and before they moved the highway, we used to get a lot of traffic out here and people used to come by and we used to make a living. We used to charge people 75 cents a day to swim in the swimming hole with the waterfall, and used to charge people to come in here and see my brother's wax sculptures. And then he set about the whoring with my wife.
See, and that part, like, and I feel like, again, like, there's so, you're right, there's so much about that twist that just does not work and kind of derails the movie. But when all the curtains are pulled back and you watch Chuck Connors kind of descend from Mr. Slauson into Davey and the mask is off and he starts talking about that, my heart kind of broke for him. Like, I was like, man, you're really giving this shit your all. Like, you are diving so deep into this character, even though it's so one note. And, you know, it was his idea to, you know, give Slauson a limp but not Davey, and really try to distinguish these two characters, and really, like, I am in awe of what Chuck Connors does with so little.
No, and that is really what you watch this for, is you watch this for that and the batshit crazy parts. Because there are some really, you know what, there's a really wonderful shot in this that is really... It's got technical restrictions because clearly it's a, you know, it's this movie was made for two dimes rubbed together.
Yeah.
But the concept of the shot and the way it's executed with what they have is really fucking neat. And it's the first kill, and the guy gets a pipe through the side, and we track down him, and we're seeing something that, by the way, I've not fucking seen before, and I don't know why I haven't seen this, but dear God, why have I not seen in horror movies guys impaled with pipes and then their blood leaking out the end of the pipe? And then it tracks across, and it's just silent, and it's quiet, and we're just tracking across this room and looking out the window. And
well, the minute it goes into him too, the sound, like, 'cause it's a very raucous scene. Like, there's all this laughter and things are clattering around and stuff's flying out of this cabinet, which, by the way, was achieved by basically attaching a cabinet to the ceiling and then fixing holes in it. And the crew were on top of it on the ceiling, throwing things down. And then, like, it's amazing the way they got this. But so there's all this noise going on. And as soon as that pipe goes in, everything goes silent. It goes slow motion and he's screaming, but you can't hear anything. And it goes back to being completely serene. And that look around, that's really fucking effective.
And it's the only good death in the movie.
Yeah. I mean,
That's the thing is...
I did think about that on this viewing, that the kills are not great.
No. And again, that's one of the problems is if you've got, you know, one of the forgiveness things that you can do for this type of movie is, well, okay, the plot's bad and the characters are awful and the actors are terrible, but how are the kills? Like, are we actually going to be entertained by, you know, the carnage, the technicality of it. Like, how are you going? And it's like, no, you're not. That one shot at the opening beginning, that is so great. And it's like, well, if this is here, let's see what else they do. And they don't. And they're constrained by their budget. They're constrained by the fact that they're shooting at night on this budget. And every scene looks like it's lit by two single lights. And there's no geography to the place.
All I'm going to say is, if this was Final Terror, you would claim that was on purpose. That it is better it is better lit than Final Terror, at the very least. Which I like Final Terror. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a better movie than this one is.
Well, Final Terror is a much better crafted movie. It's a movie where, you know, it's very well written. It's very smart about what it's doing. Whereas this, I don't think is. I feel like this is throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. And so I don't have that. You're not wrong. That is a fair criticism, that I'm not giving it the benefit of the doubt of that, because I'm sitting here going, well, you made this mistake. Why would I assume that this wasn't a mistake too? Whereas with Final Terror, it's like, well, you got this right. Maybe this is what you were going for. So you're not wrong that I am. That is a point of view that I am probably taking wrong
enough,
here.
Enough rights make a wrong turn, apparently, in this case. But, you know, what I actually really enjoy about the way that these puppets are constructed, which again just reminds me so much of Maniac, which would come out the next year.
And would do it better.
Yeah.
But this is another one of the things I do love about this movie.
Yeah, no, the everything to do with the mannequins in this movie is, like, just icky, eerie. Like, it just, like, it takes you to a primal place where you're like, I actually remember when I first reviewed this movie, which, by the way, kids, if you ever start criticizing movies and then you've been doing it for a while, never go back and read your very early reviews.
No.
Oh, dear God.
There is a steep learning curve of your first two years of reviewing movies where you just kind of change. It's why you're not really a respected film critic until after you're 30, because in your early years, you got a lot of movies to watch and you got a lot of writing to do before you figure your shit out. Yeah. So, yeah, no, I have early reviews that I just don't go back and read my first 2 years of reviews. Just don't do it.
There's a phobia I think it's called pediophobia, where you're actually afraid of dolls and lifelike, basically lifelike replications of figures. And so it does tap into a very primal thing where dolls are fucking creepy. Mannequins, therefore, as representations of people that are basically dolls, super fucking creepy. And it really plays with that. And I love, and I've mentioned this already, but I love the fact that there is all this weird, like, at certain points, the mannequins have human eyes, and then at other points they don't, but their mouths are moving, and then at other points they kind of float across the room, and the movement is very unnatural but very smooth, and it's just, and every single mannequin does something different. Every single mannequin has a different laugh, has a different voice, sings a different note, its mouth moves in a different way, its eyes are different. Like, he really, and all these things are going on, and for the first few times you see it in the movie, you don't know if it's real, if it's some kind of a effect or fabrication being orchestrated by, I mean, it is called Tourist Trap. So, I mean, you're not unreasonable to assume that it's some kind of hocus pocus that he's orchestrating to fuck with these kids. But by the time you start realizing that, yes, indeed, he has psychic abilities, it's like, oh, on top of being surrounded by creepy mannequins that seem to be moving on their own, they're moving on their own because the guy who is trying to murder us and turn us into mannequins also has psychic abilities. Like, that is a stacked deck against you that I would not want to have to go up against at all. Also, in the actual Tourist Trap in the museum, I love that they got actual actors to pretend to be animatronics. Like, that was such a great touch where it was like, that's just an actor in a costume under a mask and just moving like a regular person, but it looks so lifelike. Because it's a robot. It's like, no, that's just a person. That's just a person in a costume under a mask. But I kind of dug that because he was able to really fuck with those kids. He's like, oh, this is Custer. Oh, this is a Civil War general, and they're firing guns at you. And I thought that was a nice touch where it's like, Charles Band, you son of a bitch. That's just a person in a costume. God damn it. By the way, this is directed by David Schmoller, I believe is how you pronounce his name, who also directed, did you ever see Crawl Space with Klaus Kinski?
No.
Another very unsettling, very lost to the ages, but kind of awesome movie that I like very much. And while shooting that movie, he had to put up with, by the way, Klaus Kinski, notoriously like one of the most difficult actors of all time.
What?
Yeah, I know. When the guy who directed him on several occasions makes a documentary talking about, well, at least you died first, so I won. Yeah, you can kind of understand the reputation that Klaus Kinski has.
Well, Klaus Kinski threatened to murder him, so.
And apparently he's not the only director he's done that to. So David Schmoller's directing him in Crawl Space and actually was having so much trouble that he reached out to Werner Herzog to ask him what he should do. And Werner Herzog told him to kill Kinski. He's like, here's what you do. Please kill Kinski. And it's like, your movie is worth more from the insurance money than to finish it with Kinski. So there's all, like, there's a great documentary that Schmoller shot. It's only about 8 minutes long, about working with Klaus Kinski on this movie Crawl Space, and it's called Please Kill Mr. Kinski. And one of the stories he tells is that they go to shoot a scene and he goes, okay, action, and Klaus Kinski just starts screaming. Oh, all my life, people are yelling at me, action, action, I am not a trained monkey, la, and just like goes off. David Schmoller, being a very patient man, is like, okay, Klaus, what would you like me to say instead of action? It's like, just say Klaus. When you say Klaus, I will know it's time to start, and we will start the scene. Okay. So the next day they go to shoot, once he comes out of his trailer, and he goes, okay, we're set, lights, okay, we're rolling, and Klaus. Ah, all my life, people are yelling at me, Klaus, Klaus, and like just went into the exact same tirade. And Schmoller's like, I officially have no idea how to deal with you. So I just seeing all of that, I really kind of endeared me to this filmmaker. And I think Crawl Space is another one of those movies that definitely is worth seeking out and watching. So this to me is the great Schmoller double feature of Tourist Trap and
Crawl Space.
And Crawl Space. But even Schmoller admits that one of the things that kind of hampered this movie was that he was really surprised it got a PG rating. He thought that the, like, I guess the intensity and the scares would knock it up a notch, but it,
no,
it actually hurt the movie because it was rated PG and people didn't know it was a horror film because it was fucking rated PG. Also, this was Tourist Trap is one of the casualties of the collapse of I believe it was De Laurentiis Films, and it got like waylaid for a while in I'm mixing up my facts. That was Pumpkinhead. Pumpkinhead was way, like, hey, welcome to facts about last week's movie, kids. Pumpkinhead was one of the casualties of the collapse of De Laurentiis Films. So go ahead and put that one in your back pocket. But yeah, there is a lot to like about Tourist Trap, but then there are those moments where shit gets crazy. It just gets fucking off the rails nuts.
It is, but it's bonkers enough that I think it's worth watching. I see why I got a PG rating. The kills are nothing to speak of. In fact, I'm having a hard time remembering how most of the people died in the movie.
Well, there's one kill.
I literally watched this 2 days ago.
Yeah.
I remember the opening kill, and aside from that, I was just like, wait, oh yeah, wait, huh? No, it's a movie that I think all of the pieces in it are interesting. I don't think any of the pieces fit together properly, and I feel like the attempt to sew them together with Davey the exposition bot really hampers this film and keeps it from being as awesome as it wants to be.
Yeah.
But it is ambitious and it is trying something, and it is a really cool relic that I'm really happy you dusted off and handed to me, because I'm glad I watched this fucking thing, but it didn't work for me.
Yeah, no, but one of the kills is literally Davey with his psychic powers causes a woman's scarf to tie too tight and strangle her.
That's right.
There's also, by the way, I want to go back to the character of Polly for a second, because when she shows up in this movie, you've got like Tanya Roberts wearing a tube top and short shorts, and like there's basically only ostensibly clothing on her. And then right next to her is Polly dressed like a full-sized American Girl doll, like literally like her collar's up to her ears and she's wearing...
Yeah, when you said compound, I was like, yes, that is exactly who she is.
She's a sister wife.
In a movie with actual characters, she would be the Christian girl who her friends are taking her out to show her a good time, to show her that there is a world outside of the compound.
Which isn't the case, because, and this was its moment to establish that it completely decides to say fuck it to, because this is in fact a Charles Band movie. The scene where the one girl says, let's go swimming, and Polly says, we can't go swimming, we don't have our swimsuits. And that girl goes, so? Smash cut to Polly naked with the rest of them,
you know,
in the water.
We keep saying Polly, it's Molly.
Molly, whatever. Molly Anna. Smash cut to Molly Anna in the water.
Literally
naked.
Spent an hour calling her Polly.
I don't care. She's Polly Anna in my head. She will always be Polly Anna. But do you understand what I'm saying? Like, in any other movie, she would have stuck to her guns and being like, no, I'm not getting naked and swimming. In this movie, it goes from, we can't do that, we don't have swimsuits, to the compelling argument of, so? Being completely her undoing, and she changes and throws that out the window and says, okay, I guess I'll get naked now. Yeah, that's this movie is far more interested. And yet, there is no actual nudity in this film, because all of those scenes of them skinny dipping, they're underwater.
Well, and that's one of the things that one of the few things I was really respected about this film was, this is a film that felt like it should have been sleazy and refused to get sleazy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was cool. Like, that this is a leering, you know, crazed guy, but it's not that perverse sleaze that we were seeing in the late 70s, early 80s of like, hey, would you like to look at some naked girls? We'll wrap a movie around it so it doesn't seem like it's pornography.
Hi, I'm Charles Band.
and so the movie, I see why it got a PG rating.
You know who's going to be very disappointed by that is our old friend Porn Creep Cenobite.
Oh, Porn Creep Cenobite.
I watched this movie for the boobs. There's no boobs. Let's go, Chatterbox. Yeah, I know that's not your actual name. I don't care.
Yeah, he's going to be very upset. But I think you will be delighted to know, Cargill, that the lack of nudity in this movie, accidental. Not a conscious choice by the filmmaker. He apparently forgot to ask the actresses when they were hired if they were okay with nudity. So he kind of put it off for a while. Then we got to that scene. He's like, hey, by the way, would you be okay with nudity? And they all said no. And he didn't press the issue because he fucked up. So
yeah, because you don't. Yeah. There are rules.
And apparently, there probably weren't rules in the late 70s, but this guy still played by those rules, and you got to respect that. But I just think it's funny that, like, this is so in line with your view of this movie and how you feel about it, that, like, the one thing you're being really, like, generous and praising it for was completely accidental.
There it is.
I
need to go. I need to go back to not, you know, to being a judgmental asshole. Let's keep throwing me under the bus. You know, Cargill.
You know, would you be interested to know? Like, it's such
God
a weird, like, Monty Hall thing that I'm pulling on you. You got zonked. Man, kids, ask your grandparents about Let's Make a Deal, because I realize that reference probably soared right over your head.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry about that. I'm 1,000 years old on the inside. One thing I will freely admit that does not work for me about this movie is the score.
Oh, boy.
Because
that opening song.
Oh, God. It's like the fucking cops from Last House on the Left.
That's exactly what it felt like.
Oh, that's
I was going to be like, Jesus Christ, does this not belong in this movie? It's like the cops from the Last House on the Left.
Yeah, it even has that. I don't even know what that instrument is, where it's just like a noisemaker for New Year's that you, like, spin around, and it just makes that. It's like more of a sound effect than an instrument.
Yeah, like the only band I know that ever uses it
is Charles Cake. Band. Oh, I'm sorry, what?
Cake.
Oh, sure.
Cake uses that.
Oh, that's right. Never There. I remember that being very. Welcome back to Cake Talk. We're going to go through the entire discography of Cake. Let's go ahead and start with their cover of I Will Survive. Cargill. No.
One of my favorite covers of all time.
Well, of course
I don't
is.
Know why you pulled that out of your ass, but it really is. It's a great
cover. To me, that and Short Skirt, Long Jacket are just the pinnacle of Cake.
Actually, true story, Cake is something that Scott and I listen to whenever we're headed to something together and we're getting revved up for our day to work, like on Sinister. There were lots of days where we knew we had a hard day ahead of us, and we would put on several Cake tracks and just sing as loud as we could two various Cake songs. Short Skirt, Long Jacket is one of them. But yeah, Cake is something that me and Scott share in common.
Please tell me you were driving to set in a white Chrysler LeBaron.
No.
Kids, ask your parents who Cake is.
And ask them what a Chrysler LeBaron is.
Hey, that used to be the premier midlife crisis mobile. Don't you worry about it.
You know, here are references that younger members of our audience get, and you're never there.
Hey, so you know what the real wax museum is all of the references that we make. Just like we're.
What do you mean? What do you mean, we white man? You are going off the reservation with Let's Make a Fucking Deal. Like, I remember watching that when I was 8 and they were only in reruns. Like, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, to me, Let's Make a Deal is not just that show they're watching on tape in The Thing and they're like, I've already seen this one. No, it's a show I actually watched as a kid. I feel like I might be some kind of weird, like, quantum leap situation where I'm actually a very old person and I've somehow just leapt into this 33-year-old's body. I don't know.
And you put on a mask and pretend to be your brother?
Hey. The fucking
Stargrove. Worse than Stargrove.
Worse than Stargrove.
Than Never Too Young to Die.
Well, I mean, that's not fair because that movie is excellent. So, I mean, that's not a fair comparison. But the score at points is amazing. Like, it's fully, like, conducted and it's orchestral and it's creepy and it sets the mood. But then there's this other part of it that is, I don't like it sounds. Do you know what it sounds like? It sounds like somebody from Hooverville just showed up, or from Hooterville just showed up, and you know they want to sell
their
you,
chicken wings,
right? Hooterville chicken wings. Ask your parents. Yeah, it shows up like Mr. Haney's going to sell you a rocking chair from the back of his junk truck or something. Like, it is just, what the fuck is that? It makes you think that this is supposed to be a comedy at certain points, and it makes no
and
fucking
not,
sense.
It's not like it's one of the many pieces of this movie that just don't work.
And talking of Shameless and Charles Band, if you bought the DVD, it's not only the music that plays on the menu. The menu has a section called merchandise, and you can go and look at all of the Full Moon stuff that you can buy, right? Thing is, you can't actually buy it from the fucking DVD, so it's really just a catalog. It's a fucking digital catalog of all the merch and swag that you can buy if you're a big fan of Puppet Master.
That's what we call special features here at Blue Moon.
It's so... Do you... Do you understand why this is a studio I don't have a lot of affection for?
Oh, I get it. Like, no, Blue Moon. Well, that's the thing is, you know, Full Moon and...
I will drink Blue Moon. I will not watch Full Moon.
Full Moon and Troma, you have a loathing for.
Yeah.
Like, you just do not dig the tongue-in-cheek nature of them.
The snake oil salesmanship is what really
and I get that.
Off.
Like, but that's what it's one of the things I love about you. Like, even though you don't appreciate those films, the reason you don't appreciate those films is because you appreciate films with sincerity.
Yes.
Which is, this movie has sincerity. This movie is trying very much to be something, and you're giving it that credit, whereas many of the Full Moon features are like, we're trying to be something that you can drink a six pack to on a Friday night and go, that was fucking crazy.
The whole idea behind Full Moon and Troma, or Blue Moon, Full Moon and Troma.
Full Moon.
Full Moon. I've been drinking too many Blue Moons, which is why I can't remember Full Moon. The whole thing with them is that you don't care watching this, so why should we care making this? And I am never going to subscribe to that mentality in filmmaking. Just like, you know it's bad, you don't care, why should we? And it's like, because you're fucking making a movie that we're paying to see. Like, try a little bit, maybe. But this is pre-Full Moon. This is when Charles Band is still doing things that, even when they don't work, there's still something interesting to them. And I think there are things about Tourist Trap that, yes, I am giving it a lot of credit for swinging for the fences, but I think there are things that they legitimately hit. Like, there are things that work in this movie. Like, the imagery in this film is, you know, for this era, there's not a lot of movies from this era that I watch and will stick with me, that will, like, the images will haunt me. There's shit in this movie that fucking haunts me every time I watch it and sticks with me long after I've seen it. And I think that is, in and of itself, a high praise, you know, because that doesn't always happen. I'm glad you mentioned House of Wax, by the way, because the House of Wax remake, you and I are on record as being pro remakes. Like, we are very much, I mean, if it's a bad remake, yes, obviously we will dislike it, but the concept of remakes is not something that is anathema to us.
No.
Like, we are on board for the concept of remakes. The House of Wax remake, I don't know how you feel about it, but for me, it's a take a drink, because I actually really dig that House of Wax remake. The thing is, that House of Wax remake is not a remake of House of Wax. It's a remake of Tourist Trap. 1,000%. This is my fucking thesis, is that the people who actually made the remake of House of Wax have never fucking seen House of Wax.
But they've seen Tourist Trap.
They've seen Tourist Trap one day when they were high and forgot about it and thought it was House of Wax. It's fucking Tourist Trap. That House of Wax remake is watch Tourist Trap and then watch the House of Wax remake. Even the fucking IMDb press said there are a lot of elements of this film that are later incorporated into the House of Wax remake. I'm like, no shit, because they're actually remaking Tourist Trap and not House of Wax. It's pretty fucking incredible.
Which, and you know what? Talk about the perfect Charles Band thing to do.
Yes.
Is to remake a Charles Band movie without the rights.
because, oh, the justice is poetic.
Because, gee, did Charles Band make Dr. Mordred? No. Perhaps.
If you listen to Junk Food Cinema, I think you'd say yes. I think we may have covered it at
we
one
may
point.
Have covered. Yeah, this is, we've done, for a producer you fucking hate, we've covered three of his fucking movies. Movies, asshole.
Okay, and this one, I will give you that this one was at my behest.
you leaned hard into this one.
I did, and funny enough, I remember watching the credits.
Well, I didn't have to twist your arm on either of the other two.
No, you didn't, but they were definitely, like, Cargill picks. Like, this yeah. is a solidly Salisbury yeah. pick. But I do remember watching it for this show, revisiting it for the show and going, oh, Charles Band? Really? I just had that reaction, like, oh shit.
I don't know if there's many more Charles Bands left for us, though.
Not pre Full Moon Charles Band. You know, like what else did he produce pre Full Moon that you and I would jump on and talk about?
I, you know what? I'm desperate to sift through that filmography.
to find it. Like, I love that we're trying to spite ourselves. Like, what this is...
I have nothing against Charles okay. Band.
I love that we're trying to spite me. I like that's really the project that we're on right now.
He found his niche, and he does it well. And man, do they, you know, has he made a career out of it? Anybody that can make a career out of making movies and loving making movies, God bless you. You know, there's so many different ways to go about it. And it's one of the great things about the horror community, how the horror community is different from every other filmmaking community. in Hollywood, in that they're just everybody's best friends and everybody's fucking awesome. And if you're a douchebag, everybody figures out and don't spend any fucking time with you. Mm-hmm. And there's certain circles that people run in and that people know each other. But everybody digs what everyone else is doing and is so fucking supportive.
Yeah.
And some people struggle their whole lives, you know, just barely scraping by to keep doing this. And other people find a niche like Charles Band does, where, you know, he makes a living making these movies that an audience wants.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you get up into the upper echelon where you can make big Hollywood movies and make a shit ton of money and don't have to concern yourself with that stuff. But everybody still goes and eats together at the Masters of Horror dinners and still, you know, knows each other. And that fascinates me. And I admire what Charles Band has done. I'm not a huge fan of the Full Moon stuff. There's a couple Full Moon titles that I've enjoyed, but I haven't even bothered broaching them with you because of just the venom that is dripped from your teeth every time the words come out of your mouth.
I feel like I want to spit right now. Like, I don't know what it is, but I suddenly feel like I want to spit. By the way, spending time with douchebags feels like a great segue into another plug for patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. If you'd like to spend more time with douchebags,
we have more content for you.
We do. So definitely.
We've got a mailbag this week. We've got lots of stuff going on. We're talking about new possible things for patrons.
Yes. So excited about that. But I will say that I am not a part of the band of the band. Like, that's not something I don't think I'll ever be. I will agree with you that if you have a love of making movies and not just the love of making money, like, that's always going to show. Like, Roger Corman, for all his shysterness, still loved making, like, he was kind of like obsessed with making movies. He always wanted to be making movies. Like, that was his whole thing, is, you know, whatever capacity he could be in, whether it was directing,
it didn't have
writing,
to be good. He just wanted to make them.
He just wanted to make them. He wanted to, you know, put his name on something and be, you know, like, so I think, yeah, there, when you can have that genuine passion, it usually shows through. When you get to a point where you're literally just like, who gives a shit what it is, just as long as it makes money, and you don't even have and if that's going to be your mentality, fine. At least hire people who don't have that mentality, because that's what Corman was good at. Corman was good at hiring hungry people. And it's like, yeah, maybe he wanted to make money, but the people he put in charge of those movies, they wanted to make fucking movies.
Yeah, and some of them turned out to be geniuses.
Yeah, so like, I have to give him props for that. I'm not even sure how we got on this tangent, but...
Talking about Charles Band?
Oh, yes, of course, Charles Band.
The guy who produced this fucking movie?
I choose not to believe that.
I'm surprised
that
you don't have a crazy Charles Band impression at this point. Like, we haven't even covered that many Joel Silver movies, and you can't get through most episodes without doing a coked up Joel Silver impression.
I don't know how my Charles Band impression would differ from my Joel Silver impression is part of the problem. People would be very confused. Who am I to disparage the maker of all the subspecies movies? That is just, you know what? That's not my place. Not my place at all. And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which is going to be a little Texas specific. So you're going to have to come with me a little bit on this journey. Pecan logs. Because do you know what happens every time I go on a road trip in this fucking state? The number one tourist trap that still exists, that you will still come across, are people selling pecans. Pecans in all varieties. Turn right. Here's a giant squirrel. Take a right and here's Pecan Village.
Dude, I have a pecan tree in my fucking yard, and here in about a week or two, it's going to start dropping pecans everywhere. I'm going to have buckets of pecans around here just because I moved into a house that has a fucking pecan tree in the yard. You cannot get away from pecans here in Texas.
And yet, people will set up roadside stands and advertise it for miles and miles.
But they
and
make
miles.
Really good stuff out of pecans.
Yes, they do.
Including pecan pie.
Yes, they do. And that's why that is the perfect junk food pairing for this movie, is because it is something you can only get in quality at one of these weird little roadside stands. I don't know how they exist. Like, literally all they do is sell pecans and pecan accoutrement. And yet, there they are. There they are at the side of the road, like a little beacon, and you know you're in the middle of nowhere when you start seeing giant squirrels and all these like little turnoff signs that are like, hand hammered into the side of the road every 2 miles. They remind you, oh, you got 12 miles to go. You got 10 miles to go. You got 8 miles to go until Pecan City. And yeah, that's why to me, the Pecan Log is the perfect pairing with this movie, because it's the kind of thing you can actually purchase at a tourist trap. Cargill, where can people find you on the internet? On the highway of the internet, what off-ramp is yours?
Twitter and Instagram, Massawyrm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M.
You can find me at Bri Guy Salisbury on the Twitters. You can also follow my Facebook page, facebook.com/BriSalisburyCritic. Forgot my own name for just a second. Sorry about that. Was that because of all the full moons I drank? No, it's because of all the blue moons I drank. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/JunkFoodCinema. Please do that. And by the way, go to iTunes, rate and review us. We very recently were rated in, like, I don't remember, like 140 or something on iTunes Best Movie Podcast, which is higher than we've ever ranked before. It sounds ridiculous, but I was so excited about that. So please, those ratings and those reviews that you leave are really making a difference, and we very much appreciate it. So if you have free time and you haven't already, go to iTunes and rate and review us, because that really helps us move up, helps more people listen, potentially more patrons, potentially more things that we get to do for you guys. So I just want to remind you, as we're departing this episode and we're taking the exit to another week's done, remember that all the mistakes I made, all of the things I screamed about, it wasn't me, it was my brother Davey. Davey is really the troublemaker. That guy's a son of a bitch.